Hi, folks. Welcome to the Smartass Historian. I am, as always, the Great White Snark, Scotty J. Seated next to me is the Reverend Jeff.
How's it going?
Oh, God, I gotta tell you, man, I'm in a good place lately.
Yeah?
Yeah. Work. Excuse me, there is a message for you. Work's been going good. Bosses love what I do. I mean, I'm full-time now at Walmart.
Cool.
Well, and what was funny was I went, you know, I was working on a Friday, and the HR boss came up to me, and she was like, you know, want me to use my ladder to get some chips down for her so she could go to lunch. And I bring him down. She goes, oh, well, I was talking with the store manager, and we've been doing the schedules, and we want to offer you full time. I'm like, okay.
Yeah,
I'll fucking take it. So I signed all the paperwork. I'm a full-time employee. I get 40 hours a week.
That's cool.
Yeah. And I mean, it's actually 45, but I'm off for an hour for lunch.
An hour lunch is way better. It just...
Oh, God, yeah.
Makes you feel like you're not a little kid. I don't know why they even give people a half-hour lunch anymore. It's just so juvenile.
Well, if I work like 6 hours... then I get a half an hour lunch. If I work 8, I get a full hour. But the problem is I go in at 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
So my lunch is at 8 o'clock in the morning.
I'm just saying places.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everywhere. They should just adopt an hour lunch. I mean, seriously, come on.
Right, well, I go
in. What's the extra half hour? They got it covered anyway because usually, you know, it's a shift on, shift off situation.
Right, and I mean,
it's
especially
like someone leaves, you know.
Especially with Walmart, I mean, we got, like, my team, we all start at, like, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, you don't all take the lunch at the same time, do you? Yeah, exactly.
No, I mean, Walmart's really good about letting you manage your time. Like, I start at 4, I'll take my first break at 6.
Yeah, when I worked at AutoZone, we got an hour lunch, and it was like, we get and when I first started, I was like, we get an hour? I'm like, holy shit, this is awesome.
Right. No, it's like, I'll take my first break at 6, my lunch at 8, and my last break at 11.
Mm-hmm.
So when I get off that break at 11:15, I've got like an hour and 45 left for work. So I'm like, eh, fuck it, I can stretch this out. And I mean, I'm seeing my counselor every week, so that's... I'm probably in a good place, a place I haven't been in about a year and a half.
Yeah.
So I'm feeling good. You know, I'm back living with my mom, which, you know, as my daughter says, my mom's one of the few people I can stand being around.
Yeah. Well, biologically, you kind of have to.
Right. And I mean, my sister and my nephew are there, so I get to play with my nephew every day. What's funny is he likes to come into my room when I'm there and, like, grab my spare controller and pretend that he's playing video games with me.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's fun. All right, well, we got a story. Now, if you listen to us on Killers, Cults, and Nutjobs, you know that when we cover cases, the temporary insanity defense likes to come up on an occasion.
Yeah.
Well... it's commonplace for us now. You know, you watch a court show and they try pleading temporary insanity. But there was one, this can all get linked back to one particular case in America where it was used.
Yeah, because all court cases are precedents.
Right. Well, there was.
You know, it's like they always look for, like when they're doing something in a court case, they're all like.
Yeah, they're looking for, like.
Has it happened before? Have they used it before? Has a jury, you know, found someone guilty or innocent
right.
on a certain, you know, plea or whatever, how they're, you know, do it. So, yeah.
Well, in, trying to find the year here.
It's easier to win a case if more people have won cases.
Right.
Using that defense or whatever.
Well, there was a court
case.
It's hard
to be the first.
Yeah.
To do something.
In 1859, there was a court case where temporary insanity was first used and the case was won. And for those of you who, you know, have studied the Civil War, you probably know who I'm talking about, but we're not going to cover the rest of his career. We're going to talk about Dan Sickles, because he was part of this case that became the precedent for using temporary insanity.
Okay.
Now, he was born in 1819 in New York. Actually, he was born in New York City.
New York City!
Right. I miss those old Pace commercials, you know?
Yeah.
So, he was born to Susan Marsh and George Garrett Sickles. Now, his dad was a patent lawyer and a politician. And, well, now, he learned a printer's trade, and he studied at the University of the City of New York, you know, now New York University. And he studied law in the office of Benjamin Butler, who, Civil War general, he's famed for the order in New Orleans where, like, the women were spitting on Union soldiers. So he's like, all right, if you're going to act like prostitutes, I'll have you arrested and charged as one.
Well?
Well, I mean, Butler is not well liked by the Southerners, and especially in New Orleans. Now, and he was admitted to the bar in 1846, and he was elected a member of the New York State Assembly in 1847. Now, at the time that, as he was studying, Dan was known to frequent the prostitutes.
Yeah.
Well, he studied at this academy run by this man named Baggioli. And as the time that Dan became a lawyer, he got hooked up with Tammany Hall in New York City. And I will cover Tammany at a later mention, but you know, Tammany was like the big Democratic
crooked.
Oh, crooked as all get out.
Yeah.
I mean, Tammany was crooked. I mean, I think one of the more famous bosses was Boss Tweed. He was later on. Well, Dan, one of the things that Dan worked on, especially when he got into the assembly and later as a later into our Congress, is Dan is responsible for getting Central Park funded and built.
That's cool.
Oh yeah, I read that in this biography I'm reading on him, American Scoundrel. I'm like, what? He got Central Park funded?
This is the same Tammany Hall guy that like in the movie Gangs of New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. For those that can go.
Well, yeah, and I mean Tammany had
and it's not had Bill gangs. Cutting. It's another guy's name. They changed the name.
I yeah, but I know the gang names
Bill.
Are.
I think it was Bill. But
Bill the Butcher, I think.
Yeah, but it wasn't cutting. No. Like in the movie, it was something else.
But the thing is he got Central Park funding. Now part of what he as he was going on about this, working, you know, got into Tammany and he was studying with Baggioli, is that he was in 1853, he became a corporate counsel for New York City, which he did for Tammany. But he resigned afterward when he was appointed as Secretary of the U.S. Legislation to London under Buchanan by appointment from President Franklin Pierce. So he had to go to London. He went to England with this delegation group. Now, at the time, Dan was known for seeing prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a year after he married his instructor, Baggioli.
Yeah.
Dan married his daughter, Teresa. Now, at the time, he was 32, and Teresa was about 15 or 16. And from everything I read about Teresa, you know, she was very sophisticated for her age. She spoke five languages.
Five languages, wow.
Yeah. In 1852, for a woman to speak that many languages, that was something.
Yeah, well, no shit.
And Dan and Teresa had a daughter named Laura. Well, Dan was also known to see this very famous prostitute in New York called Fanny White. And he, what he did was he had gone, he took Fanny to London with him like 6 months before his wife and daughter were to come over.
Yeah.
And at a delegation to meet Queen Victoria. Yeah, Queen Victoria. Dan introduced Fanny to the Queen. So he's, I wanted to be there. I read this part. I'm like, dude, I so want to be there to see this shit happen, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure.
How many people have the balls to introduce a prostitute to the Queen, you know?
No shit.
So Fanny, you know, 6 months later, Fanny gets sent back. Teresa comes over. So he comes back in 1855, and he returned. He comes back in 1855. In 1856, he was elected as a member of the New York State Senate in the third district. He was reelected in 57, and in 56, he was also elected as a Democrat to the 35th Congress. So he takes his wife to D.C.
Yeah,
and they get this very beautiful house, which like they could look out their front door and see the White House.
Okay.
So I'm thinking that not the view that we always see, you know, where everyone gets their picture taken there on Pennsylvania Avenue. It's the next street up on Lafayette Square. Well, during this time, and Dan is, you know, schmoozing with congressmen and all this. Well, you know, he meets this young attorney in D.C. and he's the D.C. city attorney, or the D.A. for D.C. and his name is Philip Barton Key, who's the son of Francis Scott Key.
Well, hell, we got a famous cast.
All right.
Out here.
Oh, it's going to get more famous as this goes on. So, and by all accounts that I've read, Philip was like this very beautiful looking guy. He was a young widower. His wife had died. He had three kids, which he really didn't go visit that often. They lived in the city. They lived with like his sister. He had his own separate apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And like he'd go see his kids, but he didn't, you know, he wasn't like always visiting his kids, you know. So he met Teresa, and apparently an infatuation began between the two.
Yeah.
And Dan Sickles has no idea this is going on. So while Dan's doing all this stuff with Congress and everything, Philip is kind of like stalking Teresa a little bit at different parties throughout. Because congresswomen back then would all be like, oh, on Tuesdays from like 1 to 3, I have, you know, I have a tea party at my house.
Okay.
So Teresa would go to these. Well, Philip would meet her there and be like, oh, I didn't know you were going to be here.
Hmm.
You know? Stuff like that, and eventually these two, in Dan's home, one night, they got it on.
Oh, hello.
They had themselves a little tryst there, and I think it was in Dan's study.
Okay.
And like I said, Dan wasn't aware of all this because he was going off and mm-hmm. doing his business with Congress. So this was, I mean, from the sounds of it, these two were meeting like 2-3 times a week. Because there's a club, like a gentleman's club that's still in D.C. The name's escaping me right now. So, like, Dan or Philip would walk by Dan's house and he'd take a handkerchief. And, like, he'd wave it around in a circle or something. That was to let Teresa know that, hey, I'm available. Are you ready? Jeff, this guy went so far as to rent his own apartment where they could meet up and have sex.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's committed.
Oh, yeah, it's committed, all right. But, he would just, you know, and like, the coachman.
Yeah.
The Sickles coachman was, like, watching all this shit going on, and the maid in the house, a young Irish girl, she was watching all this shit going on.
The servants were all like, they know exactly what's happening.
Oh, yeah, the servants know what the fuck was going on. And the people...
Or the help, I should say.
Right. Now, the people in this neighborhood where he, where he lived...
Well, what year is this, you said?
This was 1859.
Okay, so yeah, it's after slavery, so yeah, be that.
No, slavery's still going on. This is 2 years before the war.
1859. I thought 1869.
No. No, so he, this is all going on through, and these two become the gossip of D.C.
Not to help slaves.
No, it was to help.
Was it?
Yeah. Dan was from New York.
Yeah,
They didn't have, okay.
Okay, sorry.
They had Irish slaves or Irish servants. They had themselves Irish servants. You know, I forget the maid's name, but she was watching this going on. The driver was watching it going. And the funny thing is everybody in D.C. knew what was going on.
Except
Dan.
Yeah. But like, you realize we all know what you're doing. But like, what am I doing?
Okay, the place was called the Clubhouse. Is where Francis was a member of. Now, all this is going on. And I'm trying to find up this... Trying to find this letter.
There's a Jason on the Wall commercial.
Oh, my mom told me about this. Someone had wrote Dan a letter.
And I know what you did last summer.
Right. Well, the thing is a lot of people speculated because, Dan was always busy with Congress.
Mm-hmm.
That he wasn't showing Teresa the intimacy which is required in a marriage. So, this is where Philip came in because he was giving her the attention that she needed. So, and I can see that. I mean, it happened to me. I didn't give my wife... Well, my wife was also a whore, but... I didn't give
That's
her...
Great.
I didn't give her attention either, and she went to someone else, and he turned out to be a bigger whore than she is, so... Hey, pass the venereal disease.
Oh, great. Did you...
Did I what?
Did she pass something on to you?
No.
Thank God.
No. I'm just now getting a healthy sexual appetite back. So on...
Well, good for you, Scott.
Yeah, unfortunately I have no one here in Illinois to use it on. So on...
Poor Rosie and her five sisters.
Shit. I'm in bed by 7, 8... I'm in bed anywhere between 7 and 8:30 at night because I go to work... So early. I wake up at 3 in the morning to go to work.
You're like, I'm too tired to jerk it.
Pretty much, yeah. Either that or I'd be like a John Hopper from Blues Traveler, fall asleep cranking it. So, on...
What?
Yeah, John Hopper, the lead singer of Blues Traveler.
Okay.
The reason why he lost all that weight is because he said he fell asleep masturbating. He goes, you know it's bad when you fall asleep masturbating. That's when you need to get help.
I never heard that.
Yeah, the reason why he lost weight was because he fell asleep cranking it. So
the reason why he felt...
Now, Dan received this note written by a woman, we don't know who, and it was dated February 24th, 1859, And it reads as following. Dear sir, with deep regret, I enclose to your address a few lines, but an indispensable duty compels me to do, seeing that you are greatly imposed upon. There is a fellow, I may say, for he is not a gentleman by any means, by the name of Philip Barton Key, and I believe the district attorney, who rents the house of a Negro man by the name of John A. Gray, situated on 15th Street between K and L Streets, for no other purpose than to meet your wife, Mrs. Sickles. He hangs a string out the window as a signal to her that he is in, and leaves the door unfastened as she walks in, and sir, I do assure you, he has as much use of your wife as you have. This is 19th century way of saying,
he's banging her.
With these few hints, I leave the rest of you to imagine. Most respectfully, your friend, RPG. Now, to this day, we have no idea who RPG is. But she wrote this letter to Dan. Now, you know, at first you don't want to believe it. But then he confronted Teresa about it. And she broke down. And she confessed everything. So Dan actually had her write out a confession.
Yeah.
Because he's a lawyer. And he called in like a friend and the maid who had witnessed all this, and they signed it as witnesses. So then Dan began investigating all this and, you know, found the John Gray, and he's like, well, yeah, I rent the apartment to him. And I've seen your wife coming in and out of it.
Oh, shit.
So this was like a Thursday when he did, you know, investigate all this. Well, on like that weekend, Philip would go outside because he was anxious for a meeting, and Teresa was secluded inside the house, and Dan was in his study, and he looked out the window, and he saw him, you know, waving a handkerchief, and Dan had a greyhound that the dog knew, and the dog got out, and he played with the dog for a little bit. So Dan was like, he's sitting there, and I bet he's sitting there in his study going, oh, that motherfucker. Oh, that son of what? Oh, that motherfucker. So Dan gets himself worked up, and he's got friends there, and his friends are going, Dan, you know, you don't want to do anything, man. Don't do something stupid.
Yeah.
So on February 27th in 1859, in Lafayette Square, which is right across from the White House, Dan leaves his house. He's got a coat on. He's got two pistols on him. And he sees Key on the street. And he takes out the first gun. And it doesn't work. So he pulls out this bigger gun. Fired the first shot, which cut across the thigh. You know, like a flesh wound. Nothing major.
Yeah.
Now, Philip is going, don't kill me! Don't kill me! And he throws a pair of opera glasses at Dan. He's like, fucking take my opera glasses! And Dan fires two more shots into the chest, which are the fatal blows. And as Dan's laying, you know, Philip is laying there and he's begging, don't kill me. Dan wants to puts the barrel up to his face to fire. Mm-hmm. And then one of his friends stops him from doing it.
Yeah.
And they just kind of let him lay there on the street. Dan walks over to the police station and goes, hey, I just shot Philip Key. Real calm and collected. And, you know, some of his friends carry him over to the clubhouse, and, you know, he dies on the pool table. And Teresa's just up in the house. She's guilt-stricken because of all this happened.
Well, yeah.
Well, she's in the middle of all this, too, she causes it. So Dan's in the police station. They arrest him on murder. And the police chief's like, you know what? I'm going to give you a better... You know, the first night is like, okay, this is, you know, you're in this cell. Well, Dan gets a better cell, like, the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of it, the police chief gives him his office to use to see visitors and lawyers and stuff.
Yeah.
So they know Dan's going to go to court for manslaughter. So Dan assembles, like, the legal team of the dream team of 1859. Yeah. He gets, like, 8 lawyers on his case. Hmm. And one of them is Thomas Megger, who goes on to lead the Irish Brigade in the Civil War.
Yeah.
Another one is Edwin Stanton, who later becomes Lincoln's Secretary of War. And, you know, there's an attorney to represent Dan's side. And then his parents come down and his in-laws come down. And, you know, what's funny is, like, when I'm reading the court case, they're sitting there. Dan's father goes to court, sits on Dan's side. And his father-in-law sits on Dan's side because they're both like, well, Dan was in the right to do it. I mean, she was having an affair. He was within legal rights to kill him.
Yeah.
And
now, of course, that shit wouldn't fly.
Well, right. That shit wouldn't fly now, but... basically, what happened was... See, I've seen courtrooms back in the day, and there was like this little box that the guilty party would stand in.
Mm-hmm.
But Dan's lawyers requested the box to be moved over to him.
Yeah.
Or over to them so they could confer with their client.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm reading the case, and, you know, one of Dan's lawyers took 2 days to do the opening argument.
Yeah.
And I think it was Megger. Megger had argued... It could have been one of the other ones, but they had argued before about temporary insanity.
Okay.
But they never argued it in a case like this. And they wanted to prove that at the moment that Dan shot Key, he was temporarily insane.
And that was like a crime of passion.
Right, crime of passion. And so they go through everything, you know, and I mean, there were days where, like, you know, they spent most of the day, like, arguing evidence, and, like, Teresa's confession was brought in, and it eventually got into the newspapers, and at this point, Teresa was back at their home in New York, which...
The court of public opinion.
Right. Well, and back then, you know, it was scandalous.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you get the letter, you know, the scarlet letter, but Dan lived at 7 miles down the road on Broadway in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, it wasn't like we know it now.
Yeah.
You know, New York City wasn't as spread as it was. So they were, like, out in the country. And what's funny is, like, actually part of the land that their house was on is a park now.
Huh.
So it was like a 7-mile trip from their house into New York. And Teresa was just locked up in the house, you know. She wasn't seen... by the public again.
Yeah.
You know, hide my shame. And people were, you know, once her confession got known, I mean, some newspapers didn't print it because, you know, hey, you know, let's give the woman some decency here. So they go through the court case and they argue it. And when the case was done, the jury took maybe an hour and a half to come back with a verdict. And they came back with the verdict of not guilty.
By reason of insanity.
Yeah, by reason of temporary insanity. So, and the thing is, you know, one thing that they could have brought into the case was that, you know, okay, well, Teresa cheated on Dan, but let's look at all the whores that Dan slept with.
Yeah.
They didn't do that. Now, the defense or the prosecution had a right to do it, but they chose not to.
Yeah, but it was irrelevant.
Right. They could have said that, you know, his cheating caused her to cheat, but...
Yeah, but this was 1859.
Right.
And
so,
they don't give a shit what the guy did.
Right.
It's about what the woman did.
Right.
Today, it would be...
Oh, today it'd be different.
It'd be like, oh, he drove her to do it.
Right.
But back then...
Well, he, you know, the woman was the man's property, so whatever he did,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And he, you know, they couldn't file charges again because, you know, one thing they could never prove.
It's do what I say, not do as I do.
Right. Well, one thing that they could never prove was if he had the first gun that Dan brought out or not, since it was laying on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
No one saw Dan pull that gun out. They just saw the second gun. So mm-hmm. They couldn't argue if Dan had the gun or if Philip had the gun. Because everyone, you know, the three
saw the first shot.
No one saw Dan shoot that gun. They just saw the second gun. So, you know, there was conflicting. They couldn't prove otherwise. You know, the reasonable doubt was there. But Dan was acquitted. Dan was found not guilty. Now, what happened was, he lost some political clout. I mean, in Congress, you know, they didn't socialize with him anymore. He just kind of stayed off to the side. And, you know, he really didn't get his fame back until he became a general in the Civil War and started winning battles.
Hmm.
Teresa just stayed at the home in New York, and she died there in 1869.
Hmm.
And then some years later, Dan remarried.
Jesus.
And, like I said, Dan's claim to fame in the Civil War was he lost a leg at Gettysburg.
Yeah.
Lower half of his right leg got taken off by a cannonball.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on display in one of the Army Medical Museums. And because he wanted his leg, you know, look at the leg that I gave for this country. And in later years, he would take dates to the museum to show them his leg. And he became friends with James Longstreet after the war. Because they faced off against each other on the second day at Gettysburg.
Yeah.
And there's this funny story that I told in my thesis. They were in Atlanta, I think it was like 1889, for a reunion.
Mm-hmm.
And they're two old men. And they got hammered. So Longstreet's like, oh, I'm going to go to my hotel now. And Dan's like, nah, you're too drunk. Let me walk you to your hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So they walked to Longstreet's hotel. And Dan goes, all right, well, I saw you here. I'm going to go head back to my hotel. And Longstreet's like, you're too fucking drunk to go to your hotel alone. So these two escorted each other back and forth to their hotels all fucking night. I would have loved to have seen that.
Yeah, no shit.
just two drunk Civil War generals just walking through the streets of Atlanta, hammered, escorting each other back and forth to their hotels.
They're like, you're too drunk to walk anywhere, sir.
Well, at that point, Sickles had one leg, and Longstreet didn't have a voice because he got shot at the Wilderness, and the bullet kind of came up through his shoulder and into his neck.
Hmm.
Hit nothing major, but his big booming voice was gone.
Hmm.
And that is the case of the very first temporary insanity defense.
Hmm. Well, hell.
It's nice to know this stuff.
Yeah.
Especially, I mean, it's Dan Sickles, you know, the fucker. I'm like I said, I'm reading the book American Scoundrel. It's his biography. I got another book on him I picked up at the Harrisburg Civil War Museum called Sickles at Gettysburg.
Okay.
I paid $22 for it, and it was signed by the author.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, it was an autographed copy sitting right there in the books in the gift shop. So I'm like, I will buy this.
Yoink.
You're right. I bought it as I was leaving the museum. Because that particular day, I had the museum all to myself, and I was enjoying it.
You have to watch Scotty when he's in the museum by himself.
I was very well behaved. I often think of that episode of The Simpsons where James Woods like, "You're Apu, you're Apu. I've watched your security tapes. Yes, and at this hour, I thought I was a hummingbird." All right, if you're looking for us out there, we are on Anchor, all major podcasting apps, and Apple Podcasts. We've got the Facebook pages. Join us there. And for the Smartass Historian. I'm Scotty J.
And I'm Jeff.
Catch you later, folks.
Bye.